watches. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, WRFN Nashville, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Yesterday, Jason Leopold reported at truthout.org that Special Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald spent more than half a day Friday at the offices of Patton Boggs, the law firm representing Bush administration political strategist Karl Rove, and that during the course of that meeting, Fitzgerald served attorneys for Rove with an indictment charging him with perjury and lying to investigators related to his role in the CIA leak case. Fitzgerald is reported to have told an attorney for Rove that his client has 24 hours to get his affairs in order. As of today, Sunday, there has been no mention of this in the establishment press that I can find. In any event, it looks like another key functionary of the Holy American Empire will be officially charged with misconduct. The U.S. has the most overtly religious government in my lifetime, and also the most corrupt and violent. I don't think this is a coincidence. It has been my observation that the more religion is flaunted in government, the more violent and repressive it will be. The more religious the nation, the more misery among the people, even as food banks and homeless shelters are run by churches. What is that about? Religious people have themselves noticed these contradictions. Brazilian Archbishop Dom Helder Camara famously said, "When I feed the poor, they call me a saint. When I ask why the poor have no food, they call me a communist." In spite of the track record of the godly, the conventional belief is that religion is the source of ethics and conscience for humanity. While I know people of faith personally and historically whose religion has spurred them to lead exemplary lives, from where I stand as a lifelong non-believer, religion more commonly is the justification for wars, brutality, despoilation of the land, and the enforcement of tyrannies as the divine right of kings. Most personally loathsome to me is the fact that all the major world religions decree the inferiority and subservience of women to men and respect us only as the mothers of men. It seems to me that the main preoccupation of the flagrantly devout is the conduct of other people's sexual activities. You can lie, murder, torture, pollute, and loot the taxpayers. As long as you attend church, don't have extramarital sex, and aren't gay, you're A-okay. Rulers love religious people because they're used to taking orders from authority figures without question, on faith, as they say. Of course, critiques of religion commonly come from non-believers. We are non-believers because we don't like what we see. What is rare and precious is when people of faith publicly confront the actual rather than idealized role of religion in society. This week on the program, I'm pleased to present to you what I think is a profound conversation between two people of faith, a Christian and a Muslim, addressing the topic, "Does God love war?" This dialogue was sponsored by the Zaytuna Institute, an Islamic seminary in California, and it took place in March in Berkeley.
Have the teachers of our religions failed us, or have we not been listening? From leaders of America's Christian right, seemingly forgetting that blessed are the peacemakers, to Jewish rabbis watching unflinchingly as collective punishment is doled out to Arabs in Palestine, to Muslim jurists ruling that civilian victims are acceptable under a just war. The three great Abrahamic faiths are increasingly facing accusations of ignoring the sanctity of life. some pointing perhaps to Malcolm X when he famously advised a group of black nationalists to leave your religion at home, are not surprised, believing religion is best at dividing, not uniting. Others argue, often just as persuasively, that this new penchant the religious have for the immediacy of violent solutions is bred from ideas other than those rooted in sound religious tradition. The same Malcolm X, after all, boldly argued from Mecca that only a belief in the oneness of God could harmonize a discordant America. Can our current leaders, and some of us, achieve a similar understanding? And so, does religion offer a way toward reconciliation, or has it instead become part of the problem? Please join us for an enlightening conversation between two teachers worth listening to, Pulitzer Prize winner and National Book Award finalist Chris Hedges and the distinguished Muslim American thinker and theologian Hamza Yusuf.
Assalamu alaikum. And good evening. It's my honor to welcome all of you on behalf of the Zaytuna Institute of Hayward, California. My name is Safir Ahmed, by the way. I should introduce myself. The good folks at Zaytuna asked me to moderate and be a host and moderator tonight, perhaps because I have a little bit in common with both our special guests and speakers tonight. Like Chris Hedges, I've been a journalist for over a couple of decades, although I wish I was half as good of a journalist as he is. And like Hamza Yusuf, I'm a Muslim. And yes, I wish I was half as good of a Muslim as he is. In any case, I'm honored to be here tonight. I just want to say a couple of things about this program and the concept here. As you can see, if you look around the room, there's a rather interesting mix of people who don't normally find themselves in the same room. And this was by design, I might add. A little bit of an ulterior motive in our planning for this, which was to bring different communities together and bring different speakers together, like the two speakers we have tonight whose paths normally don't cross. And the idea behind this program, and we hope to do a series of programs like this in the future, where we bring in people of different communities, particularly communities of faith, into the public discussion about issues that we're all concerned about. So tonight's topic, in a broad sense, we're here to talk about religion and violence, about faith and fanaticism, about the religious justification for war, both in America and abroad. And we thought we'd got two fascinating people to do that. So let me introduce you to our first speaker. Chris Hedges has been a reporter for the New York Times, and he was its Middle East bureau chief in the mid-90s. He's reported from conflicts and wars all around the world, starting with El Salvador in the 1980s. He has written from 50 different countries, and he's written a lot about conflict and war and seen a lot. And he's written two books that are related to that topic. One, which was a fascinating book with a very fascinating title, which is War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. The second one is a more recent one, Losing Moses on the Freeway, The Ten Commandments in America. And he teaches at Princeton, as I mentioned right now. So before I bring him up here, I want to read one quote to you from him. And this is taken from the introduction to War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. It's just a paragraph, and I just want to read it for you. I've been in ambushes on desolate stretches of Central American roads, shot at the marshes of southern Iraq, imprisoned at in Sudan, beaten by Saudi military police, deported from Libya and Iran, captured and held for a week by Iraqi Republican Guard during the Shiite rebellion following the first Gulf War, strafed by Russian MiG-21s in Bosnia, fired upon by Serb snipers, and shelled for days in Sarajevo with deafening rounds of heavy artillery that threw out thousands of bits of iron fragments. I have seen too much of violent death. I have tasted too much of my own fear. I have painful memories that lie buried and untouched most of the time. It is never easy when the surface. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Chris Hedges.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Safir. It's just a tremendous honor to be here with Sheikh Hamza and this great community in San Francisco. The vanquished know war. They see through the empty jingoism of those who use the abstract words of glory, honor, and patriotism to mask the cries of the wounded, the senseless killing, war profiteering, and chest-pounding grief. They know the lies the victors often do not acknowledge, the lies covered up in stately war memorials and mythic war narratives filled with stories of courage and comradeship. They know the lies that permeate the thick, self-important memoirs by amoral statesmen who make wars but do not know war. The vanquished know the essence of war, death. They see that war is a state of almost pure sin, with its goals of hatred and destruction. They know how war fosters alienation, leads inevitably to nihilism, and is a turning away from the sanctity and preservation of life. All other narratives about war too easily fall prey to the allure and seductiveness of violence, as well as the attraction of the godlike power that comes with the license to kill with impunity. But the words of the vanquished come later, sometimes long after the war, when grown men and women unpack the suffering they endured as children, what it was like to see their mother or father killed or taken away, what it was like to lose their homes, their community, their security, and be discarded as human refuse. But by then few listen. The truth about war comes out, but usually too late, and we are assured by the war makers that these stories have no bearing on the glorious violent enterprise the nation is about to inaugurate, and lapping up the myth of war and its sense of empowerment, we often prefer not to look. The current coverage of the war in Iraq does not expose the pathology of war. We see the war from the perspective of troops who fight the war, or the equally skewed perspective of foreign reporters holed up in hotels, hemmed in by drivers and bodyguards and translators and official minders. There are moments when war's face appears to these voyeurs and professional killers, perhaps from the back seat of a car, or a small child, her brains oozing out of her head lies dying. But mostly, it remains hidden. And all our knowledge of the war in Iraq has to be viewed as lacking the sweep and depth that will come one day, perhaps years from now, when a small Iraqi boy or girl reaches adulthood and unfolds for us the sad and tragic story of the invasion and bloody occupation of their nation. I have spent most of my adult life in war. I began 2 decades ago covering wars in Central America, where I spent 5 years, then the Middle East, where I spent 7, and the Balkans, where I covered the wars in Bosnia and Kosovo. My life has been marred, let me say deformed, by the organized industrial violence that year after year was an intimate part of my existence. I have watched young men bleed to death on lonely Central American dirt roads and cobblestone squares in Sarajevo. I have looked into the eyes of mothers, keening over the lifeless and mutilated bodies of their children. I have stood in warehouses with rows of corpses, including children, and breathed death into my lungs. I carry within me the ghosts of those I worked with, my comrades, now gone. We make our heroes out of clay. We laud their gallant deeds and give them uniforms with colored ribbons on their chest for acts of violence they commit or endure. They are our repositories of glory and honor, of power, self-righteousness, patriotism, and self-worship, all that we want to believe about ourselves. They are our plaster saints of war, the icons we cheer to defend us and make us and our nation great. But they are part of our civic religion, our love of power and force, our belief in our right as a chosen nation to wield this force against the weak and rule. This is our nation's idolatry of itself, and it has corrupted our religious institutions, just as it has corrupted religious institutions in other nations, fusing the will of God with the will of the state to create a potent and deadly form of idolatry. When those who return from war find the courage and the honesty to disrupt our festivities, our love affair with ourselves, our worship of this idol, we cast them out like lepers. We condemn those who return from war for their own mutilations. We listen only when they speak from the script we hand them. If they speak of terrible wounds, visible and invisible, of lies told to make them kill, of the false civic religion, an idol we worship, we fill our ears with wax. Not our boys, we say, not them, bred in our homes, endowed with goodness and decency, blessed by our God. For if it is easy for them to murder and kill, if the nation is not blessed and righteous and glorious, what does this mean about us? And so it is simpler not to see. We do not listen to the angry words that pour forth from their lips, wishing only that they would calm down, be reasonable, get some help, go away. We, the deformed, brand our returning prophets as madmen and cast them into the desert. Wars come wrapped in religious and patriotic slogans, calls for sacrifice, honor, promises of glory. They come wrapped in the claims of divine providence. It is what a grateful nation asks of its children. It is what is right and just. War is waged to make the nation and the world a better place, to cleanse evil. And war is touted as the ultimate test of manhood, where young men can find out what they are made of. War from a distance seems noble. It gives us a feeling of belonging, of comradeship, of power, of a chance to play a small bit in the great drama of human history. It promises to give us an identity as a warrior, a patriot, a believer, as long as we go along with a myth, the one the war makers need to wage war. But up close war is a soulless void. The world of war descends to barbarity, perversion, pain, and an unchecked orgy of death. It is a state where human decency and tenderness is crushed, where those who make war work overtime to reduce all love and sensitivity to smut and filth. In war, the moral order is turned upside down. All that is repulsive and feared in peacetime is lauded and cheered in war. The noise, the stench, the fear, the cries of pain, the eviscerated bodies, the bloated, stinking corpses spin us into another universe. And in this moral void, often blessed by the church or the mosque or the synagogue, the hypocrisy of our social conventions, our strict adherence to religious edicts and virtues, and utter refusal to honor others comes unglued. War, for all its horror, has the power to strip away the trivia and the banal, the empty chatter and foolish, self-righteous obsessions that fill our days. It lets us see. The Reverend William Mahady, a Catholic chaplain in Vietnam, tells of a soldier, a former altar boy, in his book Out of the Night, The Spiritual Journey of Vietnam Vets, who says to him, "Hey, chaplain, how come it's a sin to hop into a bed with a mama-san, but it's okay to blow away gooks in the bush?" Consider the question that he and I were forced to confront on that day in a jungle clearing, Mahady writes. How is it that a Christian can, with a clear conscience, spend a year in a war zone killing people and yet place his soul in jeopardy by spending a few minutes with a prostitute? If the New Testament prohibitions of sexual misconduct are to be stringently interpreted, why then are Jesus's injunctions against violence not binding in the same way? In other words, what does the commandment, "Thou shalt not kill," really mean? Of all the commandments that are broken, the Torah says, only those who murder can never be certain of forgiveness. For forgiveness, the Torah says, can only be granted by the murdered victim. Murder leaves a stain. It marks you. The Hebrew word to kill, rush, appears in the Hebrew scriptures 46 times, and the commandment is probably better translated as "do not murder," although this remains debated by biblical scholars. There is a difference between killing someone who is trying to kill you and killing someone who does not have the power to hurt you. The first is killing, and the second is murder. But killing and murder are both sinful, and those who kill, even in self-defense, must harbor the pain of taking another life within them. The failure of religious institutions, whose texts are unequivocal about murder, to address the sinful state of war has left them unable to cope with the reality of war. These institutions have little or nothing to say in wartime because the god they worship is often a false god, one that promises victory and blesses violence. We all have the capacity to commit evil. It takes little to unleash it. For those of us who have been to war, this is the knowledge that is hardest for us to digest. The knowledge that the line between the victims and the victimizers is razor thin, that human beings often find a perverse delight in destruction and death, and few can resist the pull. Wars may have to be fought to ensure survival, but they are always tragic, always sinful. They always bring to the surface the worst elements of any society, those who have a penchant for violence and a lust for absolute power. It was the criminal class that first organized the defense of Sarajevo. And when these criminals were not manning roadblocks to hold off besieging Bosnian Serb forces, they were looting, raping, and often killing the Serb residents who had remained in the city. War exposes the existence of original sin, of the sin of the world. In theological terms, war is sin, writes Mehdi. This has nothing to do with whether a particular war is justified or whether isolated incidents in a soldier's war were right or wrong. The point is that war, as a human enterprise, is a matter of sin. It is a form of hatred for one's fellow human beings. It produces alienation from others and nihilism, and it ultimately represents a turning away from God. The Marines and soldiers who fight in Iraq did not plan or organize this war. They do not seek to justify it or explain its causes. They were taught in school, in worship, at home, to meld the rhetoric of the state with the rhetoric of their religion. They were taught to believe. The symbols of the nation and their faith were interwoven, and the will of God became the will of the nation. But this trust, this belief, is shattered in war, and those who face combat see the myth used to send them to war implode. They see into war's essence, which is death. War is always about betrayal. Betrayal of the young by the old, of idealists by cynics, of soldiers by politicians. The institutions, including religious institutions, who mold us into compliant citizens, can often never be trusted again after war. And this betrayal is so deep that many never find their way back to faith. They nurse a self-destructive anger and resentment, understandable, but also crippling. Ask a combat veteran struggling to piece his shattered life back together about God and watch the words of raw vitriol spew out of his lips, an anger that races like a cascading torrent from within his soul. It is this betrayal that causes the great chasm between those who have been to war and those who have not. The occupying troops in Iraq live in what the psychiatrist Robert J. Lifton calls atrocity-producing situations. In this environment where troops are surrounded by a hostile population, simple acts such as going to a store to buy a carton of Coke means you can be killed. The fear and stress leaves troops viewing everyone around them as the enemy. And when the enemy is elusive, shadowy, and hard to find, they begin to project blame for the attacks against them on all Iraqis. The rage soldiers feel after a roadside bomb explodes, killing their comrades, is one that is easily directed, Lifton argues, to innocent civilians who may, in fact, not support the insurgents. But it is a short psychological leap and a massive moral leap. It is a leap from killing to murder. And in wars such as Vietnam, Iraq, or the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, murder soon begins to dominate the conflict. A hostile environment means that the occupying forces swiftly become socialized to commit atrocities. These killing projects are never described as such at home. They are put in terms of the necessity of improving the world, of political and spiritual renewal. You cannot kill large numbers of people without a claim to virtue. Our own campaign to rid the world of terror is expressed this way, as if once we destroy all so-called terrorists, we destroy evil. But the reality on the ground is undeniable, as any soldier or marine who has watched his unit fire on an Iraqi car too close to a checkpoint and then peered into the back seat to see the gruesome remains of a murdered family knows. War, especially modern industrial warfare, sees the razing of villages, the aerial bombing of towns, the deadly toll long after the war is ended of landmines strewn about the countryside, and the spread of disease, poverty, and birth defects caused by the poisons and destruction left behind. Murder is always an intimate part of war. But in an insurgency such as Iraq, murder outstrips killing. The local population is viewed as a base of support for armed insurgents and soon targeted. And the emotional cost is corrosive and debilitating. All this unleashes a crisis of faith. The God these soldiers and Marines knew or thought they knew fails them. They go to war unprepared for the capacity we all have for atrocity, for evil that is carried out in the name of God, freedom, and democracy. And many combat veterans are burdened by this betrayal. This is why they return and often turn their backs on organized religion, not because they have become godless, but because they have been misled by religious leaders, leaders who choose, perhaps because of their own naivete, not to teach them about the capacity we have for evil and the hollowness, but the hollowness of a religious creed that worships the nation and the self. Where is God in war? It is the question all of us who have been to war must face. I think the answer is God is not there. For war is a godless endeavor. And when love, compassion, and human kindness are replaced by the vast, grotesque panorama of violence and destruction of war, God is banished. Human beings who have the freedom to choose good and evil cannot expect to feel the power of the divine when they embrace a world of sin. At that moment, they shut out the divine. In war, we face our demons. We discover the darkness that allows us, when restraints are cut, to commit acts of horror against the weak and defenseless, including children. We discover the ghoulish delight human beings can take in killing. We discover that all is not right with the world as we had been taught, that honoring nation and family and a God that leads to victory and righteousness and success does not mean that we will be saved or indeed victorious or even successful. We discover the lie we have been told, the cheap idolatry of our civic religion, one that grafts the will to power to the will of God. And in this knowledge, we make a painful self-discovery, not only about ourselves, but about the human community. The naive belief in the goodness of the nation and the individual, one that gives us comfort and moral certitude, is obliterated forever. We peer into the human soul, and what we see looking back terrifies us. But out of that pain and alienation comes knowledge and hopefully a desire to reclaim life. Although the darkness we confront and bear becomes our cross, and all of us who have been to war carry it. There are many who cannot permit the emotionally reassuring myth of a good and moral nation, a nation ordained by God to carry out a civilizing mission by whatever means necessary in the world, to be shattered. And these people, who by their support of the war send the young to die, or perhaps to return home maimed in spirit and body, blame those who return from war and speak the truth about war for the message. This retreat into blind patriotism, which is always at its core about self-exaltation, is comforting and morally reassuring. But once you master a people by force, you depend on force for control. Isolation always impairs judgment, and we, as a nation, are very isolated now. Thucydides wrote of how Athens' expanding empire led it to become a tyrant abroad and then a tyrant at home. The tyranny Athens imposed on others, it finally imposed on itself. The lust for war, the desire for profits, saw the Athenians lose sight of the ideals that were their great gift to us, ideals that should be our legacy to others. We live on images and slogans that perpetuate fantasies about our own invulnerability, our own might, our own goodness, and these illusions blind us. We cannot see ourselves as others see us. We had fed the heart on fantasies, William Butler Yeats wrote, the heart's grown brutal from the fair. It is 1967 in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, and we have become Israel. Our empire has expanded, and in that we have become pariahs. We are propelled forward not by logic or compassion or understanding, but by fear. We have built an alliance against terror with Israel and Russia, two nations that do not shrink from gratuitous and senseless killing in the Israeli-occupied territories and Chechnya. And those who are not with us, and few are with us now, we ridicule and belittle and condemn. We have become the company we keep. Much of the world, certainly the Muslim world, one-fifth of the world's population, most of whom are not Arab, see us through the prism of Iraq, Palestine, and Chechnya. And this prism is one that is igniting the dispossessed and deteriorating by the hour our security and safety. The attacks on the World Trade Center illustrate that those who oppose us, rather than coming from another moral universe, have been schooled well in modern warfare. The dramatic explosions, the fireballs, the victims plummeting to their deaths, the collapse of the towers in Manhattan were straight out of Hollywood. Where else but from the industrialized world did the suicide bombers learn that huge explosions and death above a city skyline are a peculiar and effective form of communication? They have mastered the language we taught them. They understand that the use of indiscriminate violence against innocents is a way to make a statement. We leave the same calling cards. We delivered such incendiary messages in Vietnam, Serbia, Afghanistan, and now Iraq. It was Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara who, in the summer of 1965, defined the bombing raids that would kill hundreds of thousands of civilians north of Saigon as a means of communication to the communist regime in Hanoi. War is the pornography of violence. It has a dark beauty filled with the monstrous and the grotesque. The Bible calls it the lust of the eye and warns believers against it. War gives us a distorted sense of self. It gives us meaning. It creates a feeling of comradeship that obliterates our alienation and makes us feel, for perhaps the first time in our lives, that we belong. War allows us to rise above our small stations in life. We find nobility in the cause, even bliss. And once in a conflict, the shallowness of much of our lives becomes apparent. The fruitless search to find fulfillment in the acquisition of things and wealth and power is laid bare. The trivia that dominates our airwaves is exposed as empty chatter. War allows us to engage in lusts and passions we keep hidden in the deepest, most private interiors of our fantasy life. It allows us to destroy not only things, but human beings. And in that moment of wholesale destruction, we wield the power of the divine, the power to revoke another person's charter to live on this earth. The frenzy of this destruction, and when unit discipline breaks down, or there was no unit discipline to begin with, frenzy is the right word, sees armed bands crazed by the poisonous elixir our power to bring about the obliteration of others delivers. All things, including human beings, become objects. Objects to either gratify or destroy or both. And almost no one is immune. The contagion of the crowd sees to that. Force, Simon Weil writes, is as pitiless to the man who possesses it or thinks he does as it is to its victims. The second it crushes, the first it intoxicates. Drawn into the world of war, it becomes hard to escape. It perverts and destroys you. It pushes you closer and closer to your own annihilation, spiritual, emotional, and finally physical. It destroys the continuity of life, tearing apart all systems, economic, social, environmental, and political, that make life possible, that sustain us as human beings. I covered the war in El Salvador from 1983 to 1988. By the end, I had a nervous twitch in my face. I was evacuated 3 times by the U.S. Embassy because of tips that the death squads planned to kill me. And yet, each time I came back, I accepted with a grim fatalism that I would be killed in El Salvador. I could not articulate why I accepted my own destruction and cannot now. There came to be a part of me, maybe it is a part of all of us, which decided I would rather die like this than go back to the dull routine. During the war in El Salvador, I worked with a photographer who had a slew of close calls and then called it quits. He moved to Miami for one of the news weeklies. But life in Florida was flat, dull, and interesting. He could not adjust and soon came back. From the moment he stepped off the plane, it was clear he had returned to die. And just as there are some soldiers or war correspondents who seem to us immortal and whose loss comes as a sobering reminder that death has no favorites, there are also those in war who are locked in a grim embrace with death from which they cannot escape. He was frightening to behold, a walking corpse. He was shot through the back in a firefight and died in less than a minute. Sigmund Freud divided the forces in human nature between the Eros instinct, the impulse within us that propels us to become close to others, to preserve and conserve, and the Thanatos, or death instinct, the impulse that works towards the annihilation of all living things, including ourselves. For Freud, these forces were in eternal conflict. He was pessimistic about ever eradicating war. All human history he argued, in civilization and its discontents is a tug of war between these two instincts. Taste enough of war, and you come to believe the Stoics were right. We will, in the end, all consume ourselves in a vast conflagration. There is a constant search in war to find new perversities, new forms of death when the initial flush fades, a rearguard and finally futile effort to ward off the boredom of routine death. And this is why we would drive into towns in Bosnia and find bodies crucified on the sides of barns or decapitated and mutilated. This is why those slain in combat are treated as trophies belonging to the killers, turned into grotesque pieces of performance art. I know soldiers that to this day carry in their wallets the identity cards of men they know they killed. They take them everywhere. They show them to you with the imploring look of a lost child. They will never understand. In war, we deform ourselves, our essence. We give up individual conscience, maybe even consciousness, for the contagion of the crowd, the rush of patriotism, the belief that we must stand together as a nation in moments of extremity. To make a moral choice, to defy war's enticement, to challenge the idol and the civic religion, can be self-destructive. But war is necrophilia, and this necrophilia is central to soldiering just as it is central to the makeup of suicide bombers and terrorists. It is hidden under platitudes about duty and comradeship. It waits, especially in moments when we seem to have little to live for and no hope, or in moments when the intoxication of war is at its pitch to be unleashed. And when we spend long enough in war, it comes to us as a kind of release, a fatal and seductive embrace that can consummate the long flirtation with our own destruction. Many of those I worked with as war correspondents during the past two decades could not escape. They could not break free from this dance with death. They wandered from conflict to conflict, seeking always one more hit. By then I was back in Gaza and found myself pinned down in another ambush. A young Palestinian 15 feet away from me was shot through the chest and killed. I had been lured back, but now felt none of the old rush, just fear. It was time to break free, to let go, to accept that none of this would or could or should return. I knew it was over, and I was lucky to get out alive. Kurt Schork, brilliant, courageous, and driven, could not let go. He died in an ambush in Sierra Leone, along with another friend, Miguel Gil Moreno. His entrapment, his embrace of thanatos, of a death instinct, was never mentioned in the sterile and antiseptic memorial service staged for him in Washington. Everyone tiptoed around it. But for those of us who knew him, we understood he had been consumed. I had worked with Kurt for 10 years, starting in northern Iraq. Literate, funny, seems the brave are often funny. He and I passed books back and forth in our struggle to make sense of the madness around us. His loss is a hole that will never be filled. His ashes were placed in the Lion Cemetery in Sarajevo for the victims of the war. I flew to Sarajevo and met the British filmmaker Dan Reed. It was an overcast November day. We stood over the grave. Dan lit a candle. I recited a poem the Roman lyric poet Catullus had written to honor his dead brother. By strangers, coasts, and waters, many days at sea, I come here for the rites of your unworlding, bringing for you, the dead, these last gifts of the living, and my words, vain sounds for the man of dust. Alas, my brother, you have been taken from me. You have been taken from me, and by cold chance turned to shadow and my pain. Here are the foods of the old ceremony, appointed long ago for the starvelings under the earth. Take them. Your brother's tears have made them wet, and take into eternity my hail and my farewell. It was there, among 4,000 war dead, that Kurt belonged. He died because he could not free himself from war. He was trying to replicate what he had found in Sarajevo, but he could not. War could never be new again. Kurt had been in East Timor and Chechnya. Sierra Leone, I was sure, meant nothing to him. Kurt and Miguel could not let go. They would be the first to admit it. Spend long enough at war, and you cannot fit in anywhere else. It finally kills you. It is not a new story. It starts out like love, but it is death. War is the beautiful young nymph in the fairy tale that, when kissed, exhales the vapors of the underworld. The ancient Greeks had a word for such a fate, ek pyrosis. It means to be consumed by a ball of fire, and they used it to describe heroes. Thank you.
Hamza Yusuf's story is both of the East and the West, of both Islam and America. Born in southern Washington state, Yusuf became a Muslim in 1977. He then embarked upon a search for knowledge that took him to the United Arab Emirates, to Saudi Arabia, to North and West Africa, where he pursued studies in the various disciplines of Islam, and he has translated into modern English several classical Arabic texts. Since September 11th, he has advised the President of the United States. He has addressed the House of Lords and the Welsh Assembly in the United Kingdom. He has counseled the Secretary General of the Arab League and several Arab foreign ministers. And before I ask him to come up here, I would like to read a short quote from him. This is taken from a speech that he gave at the 2004 annual convention of the Islamic Society of North America, which is sort of the largest Muslim gathering in the United States. And this was right after the massacre in Beslan, Russia, where about 334 people were killed at the school, including half of them were about children. And he told people at this gathering of Muslims that Muslims should condemn this with no uncertain terms. And then he said this: "We do not count numbers. We do not say they killed 30,000 or they killed 3,000. We do not count numbers. Every soul is sacred, and this has to be established on the earth once again, the teaching of Abraham. The Abrahamic faiths share the sanctity of life, and the Muslims must assert their Abrahamic truth. We have to reassert to the Abrahamic people that we are the last extension of the Abrahamic truth, that there is a God, and that he communicates with his creation, and he calls them to his unity, and he calls them to the highest morality known to humankind, because the naysayers who attack religion are attacking the best of humanity, and it is only the absence of religion in religious people that leads to these types of atrocities in the name of religion. It is not religion itself. It is the misuse, the abuse, the assault on religion in the name of religion that leads to a hatred in the hearts of other people. And that is why our Prophet warned us, beware of extremism in religion, because it is extremism in religion that destroyed the people before you." Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Hamza Yusuf.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, the most merciful, the most compassionate. وصلى الله على سيدنا محمد وعلى آله وصحبه وسلم تسليما ولا حول ولا قوة إلا بالله العلي العظيم. First of all, given that we're in Berkeley, I don't want anybody to hold it against me that I advise the president. I also would say that he did not take my advice. I just came from 6 weeks of touring. I was in the UK, I went to Denmark, and then to Qatar, where I was involved in what they called a high-level United Nations meeting there. And the United Nations was actually founded, according to its foundational documents, as an attempt to actually end war. After World War I, there was an attempt to found the League of Nations, which did not succeed. It was Wilson's dream. And he actually had a stroke during the Versailles Treaty. But it really never formulated or came to anything. But the United Nations was founded apparently to end war. What's interesting is that the five permanent members of the Security Council of the United Nations, the United States of America, the United Kingdom, Russia, China. I don't know how Northern Ireland got in there. I think it was the British that finagled that one after the Ulster plantation. But what's really interesting to me is those five countries, or rather the first four, beginning with the United States, are the biggest sellers of armaments on the planet. And it's a little like putting Jesse and Frank James on the board at the bank. You know, it's a very odd thing if you think about it, you know, that these people are the people that are supposed to give us security, and yet they're flooding the world with armaments. And I really believe that the great moral task ahead of us is to bring down the armaments trade. I think it is the great moral issue of the 21st century, in the same way that abolition was the moral issue of the 19th century, and in many ways civil rights was the issue of the 20th century. I absolutely believe that ending the arms trade, the global arms trade, is the moral issue of our generation. Whenever you see these wars, and Chris Hedges, and we have to honor him for his courage to do what he did, but whenever you see these wars, you should really know that the arms that they're using were not produced in those countries. Sierra Leone does not have armaments factories. Sierra Leone has diamonds, and diamonds buy weapons, because that's how the weapons were purchased in Sierra Leone. The seventh largest purchaser of arms on this planet is Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia does not produce, it's a country of 19 million people, it does not produce armaments. It follows India, a country of over a billion people. Saudi Arabia has 19 million people, and yet is the seventh largest purchaser of arms. Why? It doesn't use them. When they were threatened with invasion, they asked the Americans to come. So the reason is because it's a way of recycling petrodollars back into our economy. That's all it is. It's Raytheon's welfare. It's General Electric. We bring good things to death. Really, I mean, and we're all complicit. You know, we have lights, you know, GE, when you put that in there, we're supporting it. You know, that's the challenge that we have. And I don't envy the young people, because the world that we're offering them, you know, the world that we're handing over to our children, for God's sake, you know, I mean, I just feel like we should be doing something for these children. I look at my children, I've got a 7-year-old that's constantly asking me questions. And he recently asked me, if you had to choose, would you rather have a hot death or a cold death? And I don't know if he was referring to, you know, nuclear holocaust as opposed to the global warming that's actually making our weather in the Bay Area a little colder. But when I look at my child with his bright eyes and his total trust in me, and then I have to realize that he needs to come of age, he needs to leave the Garden of Eden and abandon that innocence and come to a realization of the type of world that has been handed to him. Much of it is defined by war. We don't like to think about the conflicts globally, but we are almost directly involved in all of the major conflicts around the globe. Somehow, this country, our country, the United States of America, we are a country of, like all great nations, immense paradox. And that's probably at the root of war, because war is paradoxical. On the one hand, nobody wants to go to war, or so we say. On the other hand, it's something that our culture revels in. The Great Generation. Tom Brokaw telling us about the Great Generation. The Great Generation bombed Hiroshima and Nagasaki with nuclear weapons. The Great Generation is guilty of war crimes against huge civilian populations in Germany, Hamburg, Dresden. We don't like to think about that because collectively all of the Germans were guilty. We demonized them, not we, but the people before us. I was once in a grocery store and it was a Time magazine cover. Somebody was buying it ahead of me. And it had a big mushroom, and it said, "Why did we drop the bomb?" That was the Time headline. And the lady bringing it up said, "Why did we drop the bomb?" And I just said, "Listen, I didn't have anything to do with it, all right? Nothing. I wasn't even born yet. And I don't like that implication, you know, of Time magazine." The Quran says, "Tilkal umam qad khalat laha ma kasabat." Those people are gone and they have what they earned. You know, previous generations. And this is part of the major problem that we have on this planet is collective guilt. Is this projection of guilt on to a collective group of people. What Erickson calls pseudo-speciation. It's a great word. I like words like that. Pseudo-speciation. Eric Erickson, the psychologist, said that pseudo-speciation is our propensity to basically otherize people, to deem them as less than human. It's what Hitler did with the Jews in Germany. They were less than human. Untermensch, I think, is the word. The Germans considered themselves Übermensch. You know, like a Superman, Nietzsche's Superman. So everybody else was Mensch, and then you had the less than human. I was once in Spain, we were going up a street in Granada, and very unusual person was asking for money on the street. And sometimes you see people and you really marvel at just their form and where they came from, the womb they came out of. It's fascinating. But I was struck by this person, and the person I was with is a Spanish man. He said, "Hay muchos infrahumanos aquí." You know, he said, "There's a lot of infrahumanos." That was the first time I'd ever heard that word. You know, less than human, which the person wasn't, but it was. That is pseudo-speciation. It's to deem somebody as less than human, and we can't go to war without doing that. You cannot go to war without doing that to other people. It's called Guantanamizing your enemy.